Good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort. Welcome you to the March 9th Spring Pledge Drive special edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way on KZOX and Z, the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world, except for this month when Forthright Radio's Joy LeClaire will be holding forth. Joy will join me later this morning in asking you to once again to show the kind of support for Takes on the World and Forthright Radio that you have been giving us in our 12 years of joint pledging. Every time we have a pledge drive, I search for a book to offer as a premium that, at least in my view, will expand your awareness, your consciousness of the world around us and how it ticks. The book whose author I'll be speaking with in a few moments is one that does just that. This time around, it's one that you're unlikely to read or hear about because it deals with a subject that is taboo across the media spectrum, with KZOX and Takes on the World being a notable exception. And that subject is the outsized influence of the pro-Israel lobby over the U.S. Congress and our country's Middle East policy. The book is titled Congress and the Shaping of the Middle East, and the author is Kirk Beatty, a professor of political science and international relations at Boston Simmons College, who based his conclusions on more than 200 interviews he conducted with congressional staff members, lobbyists, members of Congress, and foreign embassy officials. Professor Beatty's book is not only a must-have for anyone concerned with U.S. Middle East policy, but for anyone who seriously wishes to understand how Congress functions on every critical issue. As someone who has been following congressional activity on Israel's behalf for more than 25 years, Congress and the Shaping of the Middle East was a real eye-opener, and you can share the experience of having your eyes opened for a premium of $120 by going to the phones right now and calling 895-2233 or on your computer by hitting the red donate button at kzyx.org and not miss a word of my conversation with Professor Beatty coming up in just a moment. Better yet, a sustaining pledge of $10 a month will not only get you the book, but provide the station with needed funds to maintain and upgrade our equipment in order to bring you the best on-air sound and programming that as KZYX listeners and station members you deserve. Our guest author today, Kirk Beatty, has also taught at Harvard, Wellesley, the Fletcher School at Tufts, University of Michigan, where he earned earlier his master's and doctorate degrees in political science. Professor Beatty's area of specialization is the Middle East and North Africa, and in addition to Congress and the Shaping of the Middle East, published by Seven Stories Press, he has written two other books, Egypt During the Nasser Years and Egypt During the Sadat Years. A week from this Friday, he will be among the featured speakers at a conference at the National Press Club in Washington, hosted by the Institute for Research Middle East Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, that poses the question to which most of us know the answer: is Israel's influence good or bad for America? But this morning I reached him in the Florida Keys. Welcome, Kirk Beatty, to Takes on the World.
Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm very happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, given that public discussion about the influence of the pro-Israel lobby on U.S. Middle East policy has long been taboo across the American political spectrum as well as in academia, what motivated you to spend the considerable time that you did plumbing its depths within the halls of Congress and producing such a remarkable book that your peers seem afraid to talk about or review?
Well, to begin with, thank you very much for your kind introduction. This is a subject that I've been teaching on as a university professor for longer than any other subject, that is that of the Arab-Israeli conflict, Israel-Palestine conflict. Also get into talking about, of course, the other conflicts that have unfolded in the region as well. So I've been involved with this subject matter for many, many decades. Over three decades, to be more precise. I had a situation in which it didn't make sense for me to be exiting the country to do research abroad. My children were of an age I didn't want to be pulling them out of the school system. And so I noticed that there was a lacuna of sorts in terms of studies being done in this issue area. And that is that while there, on the one hand, has been a lot of studies written about the executive branch and the role the different presidents have played over time and profound analysis of just that, that there had not been very much written at all on the role that Congress plays. And there are people who like to make the argument that the role of Congress is small by comparison with that of the executive branch. But I often questioned that position because, after all, it is Congress that is writing the checks on a regular basis, and I think that that constant flow of American support, military and economic and financial and so forth, to Israel is something that helps to keep Israel in a rather almost unassailable position, combined with U.S. backing for Israel in the halls of the United Nations. So I thought that it would be an interesting thing to investigate the role that Congress plays. And in addition to that, it just so happened that I was making my way back out to my home west, Midwest home stomping grounds one summer back in the mid-2000s. And there was a radio program that was on, I believe it was an NPR program, and they were talking about the power of agricultural interests, special interests in the agricultural sector. And I thought, given what I already knew at the time about the power of AIPAC and other groups trying to weigh in, again, in the issue area that we're discussing, that it might be interesting to see whether or not there was something structural in nature that was going on in Congress, in the way that the game itself was played, so to speak, that would provide for some interesting comparisons between what other special interest groups were doing and what the special interest groups were doing in this particular issue area. And I think I found that that was indeed the case. So those were the primary motivating factors, I think.
Did you expect to get relative silence when you completed your work in terms of reviews and interviews? This is, of course, the Israel-U.S. relationship is constantly being discussed in the mainstream media, but the perspective of why Israel is so important is rarely discussed, other than it's hinted at as being a domestic issue sometimes, and they let it go at that. So I like your comments on that.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't surprise me so much, again, because I've been tracking this for such a long time, and I think I understand it's a multidimensional phenomenon. I think that your listeners, for example, if I could get them to contemplate as they've been watching the primary debates, how often they've heard any of the people, regardless of which channel they're watching the debates on, how often they've heard any of the people who are involved in asking questions of the candidates, more specific questions, more pointed questions about the nature of the relationship between the United States and Israel. As, again, a lot of your listeners would know, there's been a rather troubled relationship between the current president of the United States and the current leader of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. And Frontline did produce an interesting presentation about this, which was there just a few weeks ago and so forth. But, on balance, people are not inclined to go there to discuss these issues in greater detail. And I think the same thing plays itself out with regard to the media in many ways as what I discovered in the halls of Congress. And that is that while on the one hand you do have people that are, of course, very supportive of the role being played by AIPAC and other more pro-right-wing Israel organizations, there are a lot of other people, a multitude of other people who are quite afraid of the backlash of being critical in any way of U.S. Policy, sort of the blind support of the United States for Israel, and for any criticism, perhaps more importantly, that might be lodged against the Israeli government and its policies. And so it's just is the case, it seems, that with the mainstream media, one is not so likely to see the more difficult questions being posed of the candidates, for example, and in turn, one is also not as likely to see people who are commenting as much on critical works that have been introduced into the literature in this area also.
Well, certainly you see in the Democratic debate that the question of support for Israel is not ever asked.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Hillary has, rather than speaking about it to the public, she writes op-ed pieces in a couple of Jewish publications or speaks to the Council of Foreign Relations or her benefactor Haim Saban's Saban Forum at Brookings Institution, which she she pledges to restart the relationship with, and reset it and invite Netanyahu on the very first day to come to visit Washington. But this is never asked in by any of the interviewers, and I think it's by a mutual agreement between the candidates and the interviewers. Certain questions won't be asked.
Yes, I wouldn't have a lot to add in that regard, except that I have years of watching and listening and hoping to hear a change in that regard without, you know, being satisfied, shall I say. So it's rather frustrating, I think, for people who are, you know, very much tuned in to what's happening in the area, and to specific changes that are happening on the ground even, and then to see that there's nothing in the way of a follow-up in terms of questions being posed to the candidates or to other important actors. You could look at what happened just recently, for example, with the call by the, or the announcement, I should say, by the Israeli government that they would be sort of laying claim to several hundred extra acres on the West Bank. And, you know, you just don't hear any then questions being raised in turn about that in any of the forums that we were alluding to a moment ago. And so the whole issue just gets kind of swept under the rug.
Well, the American people have been kind of set up for all this. In your earlier in your book, you explain how the public has been socialized over the years to support Israel, to see as a country that, quote-unquote, shares our values, while having virtually no real knowledge about how Israeli society works. Why don't you describe the socialization process as you kind of outlined in your book, which is very important?
Yeah, well, I think, again, that every individual socialization experience is unique. And so political socialization, again, for people who might not be familiar with the term, is the process by which we acquire our different our set of values and attitudes and opinions and what we perceive as our knowledge about issue in any particular political issue area. And so there's a long list of what are so-called agents of political socialization that that are influential in that regard, whether it be, you know, one's family members and opinions expressed within the family, or things that you hear from your peers, or what people pick up from the media. So it's very important to be thinking about, you know, which media people are tuning into and what they're hearing on the media, or what they learn in religious institutions of their choice, should they, you know, be inclined to go in that direction, or, you know, historical factors and so forth. So there's quite a long ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds, social class backgrounds. So there's a long list of these so-called agents of political socialization. And for any given individual, the factors are different, of course, how this kind of adds up for any one specific individual. I think on balance, though, and the public opinion polls would tend to provide some prima facie evidence for this, there is a longstanding greater degree. I don't want to say it's a super strong one, but a greater degree of sympathy for and support for Israel. And the way that I explain that, and others have explained that, I think, is to begin with the fact that it is recognized by most people as being a country that has a democratic regime. And so to begin with, there's an affinity that most Americans would have for a regime that has democratic roots and democratic practice, regardless of the shortcomings attached to the democratic practice in any particular country. And so that there is the sharing of values, but there, then beyond that, there's no understanding on the part of the broader American public of the history of the country itself, of the nature of the displacement of the what was the majority of the population of Palestine, in terms of, you know, 750 to 790,000 Palestinians being forced out of the country. There's also little appreciation for the way the political system and democracy in Israel actually functions, in the much broader range for such a tiny country, the much broader range of vibrant political ideological forces, including those historically on the far left, but ranging all the way through the center to groups that are very powerful today that one can find on the extreme right. And then you also have this religious dimension to issues, in that there are religious political parties that participate in the system in a way that we don't see so directly in this country at all. And because of the nature of the electoral system in Israel, their use of proportional representation, there's disproportionate power that can be acquired by these tiny minority parties at times, because they become crucial to the formation of coalition governments in the country. So there are those factors that are very much at play that I think, again, it's the shared democracy that causes a lot of Americans to have an affinity with Israel, even though they're ignorant about the nature of Israeli politics per se to a considerable extent. And beyond that, then, there, of course, are many other important factors, like Americans' thoughts about the Holocaust and the certain guilt that may be felt by people, perhaps more so by people of older generations. But I think even people of younger generations are taught about the Holocaust. Excellent lessons to be learned about the heinous massacre of the Jewish people that occurred under the Nazi regime, and so people are very well aware of the Holocaust and its association in a way with the State of Israel, and then there are just I think other factors, like one's contact with peers. The media, again, playing a very important role, as we were discussing earlier on here, in shaping people's views as well. One could carry on down this list, then, of these different agents of political socialization to see just how one's views have been shaped over time, from quite early on in one's acquisition of greater knowledge or sense of opinion about issues relating to Israel, Palestine, and so forth in this country, compared to the experience that people have in a lot of other places. I mean, if you travel to Europe, for example, and are exposed to just the public television and other sources of news there, the picture is radically different from that, and the representation of events unfolding in the area is radically different from what is used to seeing on most American television networks.
Well, that leads me to the next question. In every other situation, when it comes to politics, we are told follow the money. How come, even with the likes of Sheldon Adelson holding his own Republican presidential candidate's auditions, we don't hear about the money that pro-Israel donors contribute to both parties?
Well, I mean, I would argue that there have been some interesting and important changes that have occurred recently. The New York Times, of course, has run some front-page articles with regard to Sheldon Adelson's influence. And they have also talked more directly about the role that he has been playing himself in terms of his support for Jewish-Israeli settlement in West Bank territories and so forth. And so to their credit, again, I think that there is more information being provided by some media sources, like the New York Times, than has been true for a long period of time. But I do not think that this extends and covers very much, you know, what is happening with the rest of the mainstream media, and especially with anything when we're talking about media sources of a more visual nature. I just don't. It's not that, I have the time to scrutinize what's being delivered on CNN and MSNBC and Fox and the PBS NewsHour on a regular basis at all. But you know, when one watches these things over the number of years that I've been watching it, then you become again aware of the fact that there really isn't very much in the way of full attention being brought to the specific question that you're raising about the significance of donor support from specific sources. Like that of Sheldon Adelson.
Oh, well, actually, I was also talking about the PAC money, and what's interesting, as you point out, that the function of the political action committees and how those funding politicians committed to putting Israel's interest first, if so, before that of the United States, if required, differ from those backing other special interests, such as the oil companies, insurance companies, banks, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, which identify what they are. We talk about these stealth PACs, the ones that
right.
we support Israel. Perhaps you explain that.
Yes, yes. Well, so by Richard Curtis, former Ambassador Richard Curtis, some other scholars, people began to notice that there were these so-called stealth PACs that were being created several decades ago. They often have names like the Sunshine PAC or the Desert Caucus and so forth. They're rather innocuous or generic sounding in terms of their actual titles. And what people, though, who then dug into the matter discovered was that you had people who were bundling money, putting together money in the form of these PACs to provide support for more, again, right-wing pro-Israel government positions for the most part. And so this is how they acquired the name of stealth PACs. And it's something that, again, a lot of people would, in the general public, remain ignorant to unless they had taken a stronger interest and dug in and read about these things. I think the situation with the PACs has evolved somewhat over time. I think that these practices are still important ones. You had a case recently where somebody had found a way to deliver a large amount of money to Senator Harry Reid that ended up causing the individual to get into some legal hot water and apparently was in prison for a couple of years. But by and large, a lot of this stuff goes on, and there aren't these kind of mistakes being made by people along the way. It's all kind of above board in terms of the gifting that's happening. But people are not aware of the fact that it's happening, I think, really on the scale that it is, because there actually is more in the way of campaign finance donations being made in this issue area than there is on a lot of the other hot-button issues in the U.S., whether it's things relating to pro-life, pro-choice, or you know, gun reform legislation, and so forth. There's actually, and I think most people would find this surprising, more money spent on trying to provide backing for candidates that are being vetted and are committing themselves to kind of an almost unquestioning support for Israeli government policy position as they're you know, presenting themselves as new candidates, or as they are representing themselves as people who have already been serving in Congress. So you have things along these lines that are extremely important that are going on. You also have, of course, though, the fact that in some cases you can have individual donors who weigh in so heavily, like Sheldon Adelson does, that he gets the attention of a lot of people, and the donations are more difficult to track these days because of the introduction of the Citizens United ruling. And then one final note I would make along these lines that some people might be aware of, but perhaps a lot of the listeners would not be, and that is that there are the so-called leadership PACs have taken on greater significance in recent years as well. And so you have people who are important members of the Senate, let's say, who establish their own leadership PACs, and they then can take money that they can attract and turn around and dole it out in certain amounts to people who are running for other positions in Congress. And therefore, if it's known that these people who are in control of these important leadership PACs are providing the source of money along these lines, then people are more likely to be, somewhat beholden to them, and not likely to rock the boat and take positions in opposition to the people that are the holders of these leadership pacts. And once again, then you would find the great preponderance of these to be held by and used by people that are adopting these kind of unquestioning commitments to Israel positions.
One of the interesting things is that you point out something I've learned over the years, how even before certain individuals with political ambitions have committed themselves to running for Congress, AIPAC spots them, brings them into the fold, much like a football coach looking at a high school prospect for the big university. They travel around the country looking to recruit those high school prospects. AIPAC does the same thing with local politicians, for members of Congress. And then they shape your views by sending them on trips, or other Jewish organizations send them on trips to Israel to kind of bring them into the fold. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it's very interesting. I mean, all of this is done in a way that's completely above board, but the attention to detail, shall we say, is quite remarkable. And so you can have people that are running for municipal councils, let's say, maybe people with an eye to individuals looking in major American cities and so forth, who strike interested individuals as being really promising candidates. And so from a very early time, you know, they're spotting people who might be quite young still, who are just entering into the political fray. And if they do approach them, and having approached them, they'll try to get a sense of where they're coming from and what their political orientation is and what they think about the Israel-Palestine issues or Arab-Israeli matters and so forth, or Iran. And if they sense that there's the ability to further shape the thinking of these people in a direction that's amenable to their own interests, then the offer of trips to Israel and so forth is proffered, and people, of course, often take them up on these offers. In the case of AIPAC, what they did was that they established the American Israel Education Foundation. So they created another organization that has a different legal status than the one that that AIPAC itself has, which then permits it to be doing things like providing these educational trips, which take people, including current members of Congress, of course, on trips, week-long trips to Israel, but also included in the mix and might be people, again, who are, as I was saying before, just getting started out in politics. Once they're in Israel, of course, and you've had people that have written about this, and I have quoted people that have been on these trips themselves. Staffers sometimes, of course, are going along as well. And some members of Congress and other individuals, some people who are not yet members of Congress. I've also spoken to some people who fit into that category as well. And what one is likely to be exposed to there then are really the views of more of the right-wing politicians on the Israeli political spectrum, and or far right-wing perspectives, as opposed to, of course, being taken out to see and have the opportunity to speak in greater detail with people that are representing a Palestinian perspective or an Arab-Israeli perspective. And so the exposure is an important one. People get a strong sense of Israel being a very tiny country physically, and therefore a tiny country if surrounded by countries that are perceived to be hostile countries to a considerable extent, that it's therefore vulnerable and therefore that much more, of course, in need of continued U.S. assistance. But again, the bias in terms of the presentation, and actually, let's use the term again, the socialization of the people who are along on these trips is one that tends to try to bring them in the direction of being much more strongly supportive of the policies of the Israeli government, regardless of, again, what those policies are actually all about.
We're running short on time as we're actually pledging for, this is our spring pledge drive, and we are hoping to get our supporters to call in to get copies of this book and support our radio station. We're going to talk about a little bit more about your book when we get off the air. But I wanted to ask you, before I mention this, before and during both U.S. wars in Iraq, opponents of the war were quick to raise a slogan, "No Blood for Oil," while resisting those who knew better and were, such as in 2003, pointing to the role of the pro-Israel neocons like Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, and Douglas Feith in pushing for that war and fabricating the lies that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. From your conversations with congressional staffers, it seemed that no lobbyists for the oil companies approached them or members of Congress advocating for the war. What does that say about those who still believe the war was to take over Iraq's oil fields for U.S. companies, which didn't happen?
Yeah, well, if you'll allow me to go back, because I think this is one of the more interesting, well, there are many interesting findings and a lot of fascinating quotes in the book, I think. One of the interesting discoveries was that when I would ask questions in a very open-ended way. And so I would ask the staffers which lobbyists came in and talked to them, and which ones did they find to be most important to listen to, and so on and so forth. And so I did this, as you noted in your introduction, somewhere on the order of about 150 times on the Hill. And in every single case, there was not one single individual who started talking about, or who ever talked about, people coming in representing oil companies. And this included, of course, doing interviews with people from major oil-producing states. And so, you know, I would sit listening to them, quite surprised initially that no one was making any mention of in quotation marks, the oil lobby. And so then after they were done discussing matters along those lines, I would say, well, what about the oil lobby? Don't you hear from them? And this was in every single case, again, met by this silence, the person sitting back and thinking a moment longer and saying, "No, they don't. No, we don't hear from them. They don't weigh in on these issues whatsoever." And so I just found that fascinating that was the case. I think that what's going on in terms of the way other people then have tried to portray the war for oil kind of presentation of things or representation of things is that people from across the political spectrum, from the left and the right, I think, have maybe an interest in trying to sell the idea that it must be almost as a way of perhaps creating some sort of a smoke screen that this was something that was being advocated by the big oil companies and oil interests and an oil lobby, as a way of concealing really what was going on behind the scenes, and which people have come to learn was going on behind the scenes. And that is, of course, the establishment of a special group within the Pentagon and different people, again, from the executive branch, Vice President Cheney and Scooter Libby and other people making their trips over to the Pentagon, kind of unprecedented trips, in order to try to talk to people who were coming from predominantly neocon backgrounds that were operating within the Pentagon and who were trying to sell the war effort. Now, it is the case that, and the only mention I had by one staffer was that if you go back into the 90s, ironically, you had Cheney himself, who, along with a group called USA, sort of Star, Engage, is the way that it appears in print, involved in lobbying Congress, and they were trying to block things like the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act and so forth, but you know, rather than they're eliciting a positive response to this, they actually got completely clobbered because the strength of the interests backing the legislation I just mentioned and people that were from more like right-wing pro-Israel perspective were so strong that they got nowhere in terms of trying to make their pitch. And so what happened over time then was that Cheney jumped ship and so forth.
And,
so,
at that point, we actually have to jump ship. I really hate to do that, but we have to raise money
Best
for our
of luck
station
to you.
Today. And have you been interviewed, by the way, on any other public radio station?
I have not yet. I had one request, but I was unable to meet it. So,
well, that's what we're here for. Kirk Beatty, thank you so much for being our guest today, and thank you for writing that book. And I'm going to recommend people get it to their libraries, to their high schools, as well as for themselves. So thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Thank you so very much.
Take care.
All the best.
Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.